From NPR News, this is Science Friday. I'm Paul Rayburn. Sometime last weekend, something happened out there. Jupiter was on its long, majestic arc around the sun when it was struck by something. Maybe a space rock or a comet or an asteroid. Nobody knows yet. But this thing was roughly the size of planet Earth. And when it collided with Jupiter, it kicked up a shower of darkly colored debris near the planet's south pole, leaving what looked like a black scar on Jupiter's swirling colors. Scientists around the world scrambled to turn their telescopes on Jupiter to try to figure out what had happened. And they're crunching the numbers and conferring to see what they might learn from this very rare event. But the professionals were not the first to see that ominous That honor goes to an amateur astronomer in Australia who spotted it with his backyard telescope. And we have him on the line. Anthony Wesley is an amateur astronomer in Murrumbateman, Australia, near Canberra. Welcome to Science Friday, Mr. Wesley. Thanks for getting up in the middle of the night to join us.
Hello, Paul. No, it's a pleasure.
How is my Australian pronunciation there? Close?
You're doing very well.
We have a second guest with us who's been working day and night to do some of the number crunching and figure out what happened. That's Lee Fletcher, a planetary scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. He joins us from a studio there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Fletcher.
Hello, good afternoon. Thanks for talking to us today.
Nice to have both of you here. So, Anthony Wesley, how much time do you spend every day gazing at Jupiter?
Paul, the location of Jupiter changes throughout the year. Right at the moment, Jupiter is particularly well placed for amateur astronomers and professional astronomers to take images for many long hours every night. And Jupiter will reach the closest point to the Earth and the point where it's opposite the Sun in another couple of weeks. And at that point, it's visible essentially all night. And available for anyone who wants to look at it, look at its beautiful colours through a telescope or take any photographs of it. So at the moment, at this time of year especially, I'm in good weather conditions, I can be out there for 4 or 5 hours.
Now, I guess the rock that hit Jupiter was not the size of the Earth. The scar is the size of the Earth. Was that clearly visible to you with your telescope in the backyard?
The location of the impact was clearly visible when I was looking at it last Sunday night. The impact site, as you say, has left a mark on Jupiter, or a mark in the clouds, the cloud tops of Jupiter, roughly the size of the Earth, and slowly getting larger as the debris and the material from this explosion and impact slowly spreads out and starts to dissipate.
Now, Lee Fletcher, how did you and your professional colleagues let Anthony Wesley in Australia beat you to the discovery?
That's an excellent question. The key advantage that amateur astronomers have over the professionals is the benefit of time. These guys have their own equipment, extremely dedicated guys that are out there night in, day and night to observe these events. Now, we were, it was just a normal Sunday afternoon here in California, and my colleague and I, Glenn Orton, had already got time scheduled on the NASA infrared telescope that's based out in Hawaii. And so when Anthony's news started to circulate that he'd made this incredible discovery of a dark bruise-like smudge on the south pole of Jupiter, we suddenly got extremely excited about it, and we were crowded around our computer screens here at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, waiting for those infrared images to come in. And Anthony, I'm very happy to say, was able to participate in those first observations. And so we all got to celebrate together when we first saw what was happening.
Now, Anthony Wesley, did you know you had something hot when you spotted this?
It did take a while for my eyes to convince my brain that I was seeing something very out of the ordinary. It's not unusual to see dark shadows being cast on Jupiter from one of the four Jovian moons. That's a fairly regular occurrence. I hadn't seen in the years that I've been watching any of these shadows being cast way down near the South Pole where this spot happened to be. So that looked a little bit unusual to me. I could also see, I guess, as the spot rotated a little further around into view, in the nighttime hours of Monday morning, that it was not the circular shape that you would see or that you would expect to see from Earth if it was simply a shadow projected from one of the moons. The spot looked very much like it was circular on the surface of the planet, but we were seeing it at an oblique angle. So it was definitely something very unusual and very out of the ordinary.
And when you realized that, how did you let the rest of the world know?
I was up here at the house starting to send emails at about 2 o'clock Monday morning, and really at that stage was shaking with excitement and hoping desperately that Lee or Glenn or any of their colleagues were close to their computer and were able to pick up my email. I didn't know at that stage that Glenn and Lee had time already organized for imaging Jupiter that same day. I was hoping that they would pick up on the emails and be able to organize time.
Did you know these folks, or did you just meet them as a result of this discovery?
I've corresponded with Glenn many times over the last few months or last couple of years. It's becoming more common these days for the professional astronomers to take images from amateurs on a semi-regular basis, just to keep an eye on Jupiter and see if anything unusual is happening.
Now, who is Glenn?
Okay, Glenn is Dr. Glenn Orton. That is Lee's colleague. He's a... you have to correct me here if I'm wrong, Lee. He's a planetary scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Glenn Orton has been at the Jet Propulsion Lab for over 30 years now and has been involved in outer planet gas giants and dynamics for all of that time.
Now, Lee Fletcher, Anthony gave you this image, gave you this heads up. It's up to you, I guess, not so much him, to figure out what happened. So what do we know so far?
Well, a lot of the things that we're finding out about this this incredible collision are based on comparisons to a similar event back in July of 1994. In fact, as the media have been reporting, the event was almost 15 years ago to the day for Schumacher Levy 9. Now, when we look at the impact scar itself, we're seeing that, that there's a small, dark, localized feature and a region of debris that's extending out to the northwest. Well, that already tells us something about the impact. What happens is you have this huge amount of energy and momentum of the impactor as it plummels in towards its fate in the Jovian atmosphere. And it creates, when it first hits, a kind of splashback along the direction that the impactor came from. So in this case, from the northwest. And that splashback of material pulls a lot of ammonia gas, various aerosols, particulates, dust, and some really exotic molecules and particles high up into the Jovian atmosphere. And what we can do with the infrared telescopes here on Earth is sort of determine the three-dimensional structure of that splashback. And it's that splash that we've been now tracking over the past 5 days since this impact occurred. There's a huge amount of work to do. And I have to say that the professional astronomers, there's an international team now involved in trying to determine the aftermath of this event. Just to go back to your original question, we believe, by comparison to Schumacher-Levy 9, that the impactor itself was of the order of a few hundred metres across. And given the prevalence of large icy material in the outer solar system, it seems likely that this was an icy body that collided with Jupiter.
So let's take a question. I have Alistair in Oregon. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
The gentleman already answered a portion of my question, but I was just trying to visualize as far as what it would have looked like with this impact on the surface of Jupiter. I've heard two conflicting accounts that the surface of Jupiter is almost kind of like a semi-liquid hydrogen-type mass there below the gaseous outer atmosphere, or is just a solid mass of swirling gas. So what exactly did this rock or icy body hit, and what is the effect of the impact on the actual surface of Jupiter?
Lee Fletcher, I had exactly the same question. When you talk about debris, what was that stuff?
That's a really great question. And what you have to visualize here is a rocky body that's plummeting down through the various gassy layers of Jupiter's outer atmosphere. Now, Jupiter is a big ball of hydrogen and helium gas. That's the most dominant gases that are there. But there's also a lot of trace compounds, things like ammonia and methane and various other heavier molecules, hydrocarbons, for example. Now, these ammonia in particular, at a particular altitude in Jupiter's atmosphere, starts to condense. And if you imagine an image of Jupiter in your mind's eye and you see those incredible banded structures and the great red spot that all have these different colours, what you're seeing there is the cloud tops, these condensed molecules in the atmosphere of Jupiter. Now, as the rock came in, plummeting towards these cloud tops, it would have been disrupted, it would have started to vaporise, and it would deposit all of its kinetic energy into the surrounding atmosphere. That initiates this huge splash black and plume of material. And what we're seeing in the near-infrared and what Anthony was seeing in the visible, that dark patch, is the sort of dusty aerosol deposits as an aftermath of that collision. But you're right. This is a giant fluid ball of gas where the pressure increases as you go down towards the centre of the planet.
Thanks, Alistair.
Thank you.
Don in Michigan, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. I have a million questions, but my
pick
my
one.
My first question is, I've heard different accounts as far as this, what the size might be. One of them was as big as the Pacific Ocean. If that is the case, how was this missed? I mean, this thing must have been huge. If we would not have had Jupiter in the way to act as a magnet to suck this thing in, how soon would we have noticed this thing bearing, I mean, if it was going in our general direction, how soon would we have noticed this thing traveling at the speed it is and the size it is? And two, is there any evidence to suggest that it might be part of a field that was included in the Levy comet?
Lee Fletcher?
Okay, let's start with the beginning of that question. Now, We've got to distinguish here between the size of the impact field, the ejector and the debris that we're seeing, and the size of the body that caused the impact itself. Now, what happens is this plume of material we've been talking about rises so high in the atmosphere that it's easily spread over an area that's, yes, you're absolutely right, the size of the Pacific, comparable in scale to the size of the Earth. But the impact itself was much, much, much smaller than that. When we looked at the at least 16 fragments of Schumacher-Levy 9 that collided with Jupiter in 1994, they were at the absolute maximum a kilometre across, and it's more reasonable to suppose that this particular object was only a few tens to maybe a few hundreds of metres across. Now, if you imagine that the way that we spot these features is by the reflected light from the sun, and out at the orbit at Jupiter, there's not a lot of that light available for us to spot these things. In fact, Schumacher-Levy 9 was only observed by Gene Schumacher and his team because they were doing a very deep sky survey at the time. Imagine as well, another great example is the fact that Saturn's rings contains material that can be of these metres to tens of metre sizes, and we have no hope of resolving those from planet Earth. So I find the fact that we didn't spot it not unsurprising.
Thanks, Dan. Let me remind listeners, I'm Paul Rayburn, and this is Science Friday from NPR News. Anthony Wesley, what type of setup do you have in your backyard? Are we talking hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment, and your family's deserted you because of your obsession?
No, not quite that radical. No, in fact, all I have is what would be considered a relatively average, maybe slightly more than average setup for a backyard amateur astronomer these days. It would have been the case, I suppose, that if we looked back 10 to 20 years ago, perhaps more like 20 years ago, your average home astronomer would have a telescope somewhere in the 6 to 8 inch diameter mirror. And as time has gone by now with the increase in technology and the ability for manufacturers to make these optical components with great precision at ever larger sizes, now really the 14.5-inch telescope that I have here would really be considered a mid-range or middle of the class in terms of size.
What does it take to get into this? Can somebody get into it for a couple of hundred bucks, or does it take a little more than that?
Look, people can get into it for almost nothing. Astronomy, like many of these hobbies, has a whole range of different areas, and really people I know can get into astronomy with nothing more than a good pair of binoculars. Probably the most important thing that you need to think of if you're considering getting into astronomy or if you have some interest in it is to contact some other people in your area that are already into the hobby and maybe are members of a local club or society, and just take the opportunity to go talk with them and maybe look at what they've got, look through their telescopes to get a bit of an idea of this slippery slope before you start going down that path, because this hobby is like cameras, and it's like many other hobbies. Once you start, it's a great way to spend a lot of money.
So what do you plan to discover next?
Look, I don't know. I'm just going to keep on taking photographs, I think.
Hey, I'd like to thank you both for being with us. My guests this hour have been Anthony Wesley, an amateur astronomer in Murrum Bateman, Australia, near Canberra, and Lee Fletcher, a planetary scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Thanks to both of you for joining me.
Okay. Thank you so much.
And it was nice to meet you, Lee. Thank you.
And you too, Anthony.
Well, glad to have hooked the two of you up. This program has been produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Bergquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. And Laura Pelcher is our science arts producer. Our intern is Eric Ortlip. Neil Rauch is our technical director. He's at the controls right here in New York. We've also had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you'd like to write us a letter, an old-fashioned letter, please send it to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, Room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can email us at scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you when you go as a podcast. Science Friday has a new survey on our website. We're trying to get a better idea of who you are. If you have 2 minutes, please take a look. For NPR News in New York, I'm Paul Rayburn.